like all the rest of Ayn Rand stuff, it's absolute steel. It's absolute steel. She's a great writer.
Great writer.
Rubbish. Absolute rubbish. I actually heard her in Boston at the town hall. She was there for an appearance, and she was talking about her radical capitalism, you know, the untried idea, the idea that no one's ever tried. And someone said, you know, do you really want capitalism for the water company? For electricity? Now, what would that mean? That you could have competition between one and another? Think of the startup costs for a water company. And you want them uncontrolled. So if one gets the market, they can do what they want with the price. Then just imagine a water company that does a good job and gets the market and then raises the price. Another company's going to set up new pipes, new reservoirs, new, right? It's inconceivable, right? So you have a monopoly that will control. You know, she had no answers to questions like that. Not sure. Anyway. And in the end, her own institution became riddled with corruption and backbiting and inner fighting. I have a book at home which traces the end of her.
It's objectivism.
Oh, that's a name. That's
why is it called that, really?
Because it sounds good. It has nothing to do with anything. Now she isn't taught in a single philosophy department in the world. Nobody can take her seriously. She's really taught in literature departments, but as philosophy. Yeah.
There's some amazing points. You know, she says good things. But
yeah. Okay. I'm glad the tapes are here because as a little introduction, the Chasam Sofer was a fabulous genius. He learned for 14 years, one of seven under Rav Nasan Adler and seven under somebody else, I forget. Mm-hmm. And then he became Rosh Hashiva. He used to learn and teach all morning. And he would come home mid-afternoon or early afternoon for lunch. Over lunch, he would read Shilas. And after lunch, he would write out the answers. He didn't look at any sort. Because after 14 years of learning the way he learned, he had it all in his head. He wrote hundreds of tshuvas. Towards the end of his life, someone wrote a particularly bitter attack on the tshuva that he had written. So he writes back, I want you to know that in all of my responses, in all of my tshuvas, I only made two mistakes. And one of them, people tell me, wasn't a mistake. They think I was right. But I know I was wrong. And you chutzpah yakeh, you're coming along and telling me that I had a mistake? You're like, who are you? Anyway, last week I told you that I had made a mistake. I'm going over the sugi more carefully with the chavrusa. I see that it's not so clear that I made a mistake. And I want to just tell you what the Gemara says, and what the Maharal says, and what a few friends of mine and I came up with to understand the Gemara, because it's kind of important in terms of our attitude towards Talmud Torah and other things that people do. There's a problem with the gears in the Gemara, but I'll tell you what's written in our Gemara. What's written in our Gemara is this. At the end of the Megillah, it says that Mordechai was acceptable to the majority of his brothers. Ratzui l'rov echav. Says the Gemara, Malameit she pershu mimenu mikza Sanhedrin. A minority of the Sanhedrin dissociated from him, cut themselves off from him. Because they said, you were in full-time learning, you were the head of Sanhedrin, and you went into politics, and you shouldn't have done that. So stay. And Rav Yosef said, who's an Amora, and Rav Yosef said, greater is Talmud Torah than saving life. Gedola Talmud Torah mehatzalas nefashos. And there's a Taz of course is not Megmar, there's a Taz that says, if a person is learning and someone else is in danger of dying, of course the halacha is he has to break off his learning and save the person who's in danger, So that's what he should do. He should break off learning and save the person who's in danger, but he should know that he's losing out. He's losing out. It's as if to say Providence rejected his learning and therefore gave him this other mitzvah to do. Had he had more schus, more merit, then he wouldn't have been interrupted in his learning. Them's the facts. Now what to do with the facts? So I always thought that if it says that the minority of the Sanhedrin cut themselves off from him, then the majority of the Sanhedrin must agree with him. And therefore, what he did must have been right. But then there's the question, if so, if it's a question majority-minority, how could Rabbi Yosef go on to somehow take that idea and say that it's right, if it's only the minority? How could he side with the minority against the majority? How could the Taz say what he said, although the Taz isn't directly related to the Gemara, but it's sort of similar? Worse than that, let's go back to Mordechai. What was the situation there? We're being told they criticized him for leaving Torah and going into politics. Now, was he saving lives? Were lives in danger? To say Rav Yosef is related to what the Gemara said makes it sound like lives are in danger. Well, if lives were in danger, of course you have to stop learning to save life. There's no question about that. It's not controversial. If you're learning and see somebody drowning, whether you should go and save him or not, that's not a controversial item. The only controversy in stopping Talmud Torah is, can the mitzvah be done by somebody else? If the mitzvah be done by somebody else, so then you shouldn't stop learning, let somebody else do it. If not, you have to do it yourself. So we don't even understand how the Gemara, how the Sanhedrin could have had a discussion about this. What the majority were with him, the minority were against him. On what issue? If they're life in danger, and he's the only one who can save life, so then, of course, he has to stop learning to save life. And if others can save life, then, of course, he shouldn't stop learning. He should let the others do it. So the whole Gemara is just very difficult to understand. Now, let me put the facts on the table. Now, the Maharal doesn't really, and this is Maharal in his commentary on the Megillah, doesn't really explain how to understand the Gemara well. At least he doesn't answer the questions that I'm raising. But he does say what I said. That's why I say that what I said wasn't clearly wrong. He does say this position that Mordechai is being criticized for leaving learning and going to politics, that's a position of the minority. But the majority agreed with him. And of course the majority are right. And the Maharal gives an explanation as to why the majority were right, what the minority thought, and why the majority are right. So at least what I told you wasn't crazy. You know, the Maharal actually says that in the end of his commentary on the Megillah. And here is what some friends of mine, we looked around, I couldn't see anybody analyzing the sugi who answered these questions. Maybe what we came up with is so obvious, or maybe it's dead wrong. But this is what we came up with. First of all, what exactly is the danger to life that Mordechai was protecting against? Whose life was in danger? Huh? Yeah, no. You weren't there. We're talking now about the very end of the Megillah, the very end, where it says that he was acceptable to the majority of his brothers, and the minority disagreed with what he was doing. The end of the Megillah, all the way after we fought the war, and the war is over. Esther has identified herself as queen. He becomes prime minister. The question is, why should he become prime minister? Should he be learning? Let him stay learning. So our understanding is, how many people were killed by the Jews in that war? 75,800. Huh? That's what the Megillah says. How many people in all the provinces? 75,500 the first day in Shushan, 300 the second day. No, those 75,800 people have relatives. And they have friends. And one could expect that they're a little upset. So there could be reprisals. There could be reprisals. Now, if the prime minister is a Jew, that could hold down the reprisals. Because they could expect that if there was one knockout, there'll be another knockout. So Mordechai is stepping in as prime minister to protect against a kind of generalized threat. It certainly could happen. No one knows for sure that it will happen. It could happen. Maybe having the queen there is enough. Maybe you don't have to have a Jewish prime minister. Who knows? Right? It's a kind of... Everybody agrees that it is clear danger to life. You have to stop learning to save. Everybody agrees that if the mitzvah can be done by somebody else, you don't have to stop learning to save. The question is, how clear is this danger? How serious is this danger? Therefore, the Sanhedrin was not debating a halachic issue. If it were a halachic issue, it's open and shut. There's nothing to debate. Any mitzvah that can only be done by you, you have to stop learning to do. If it can be done by other people, then you don't stop learning to do. No, but this was a gray area. How pressing is this mitzvah? It's the possibility of reprisals, and it's not clear whether you really need to be there to stop it. On that, the majority said under these conditions, it's good to take precautions, and yes, it was right for you to stop learning and to go into politics. And the minority said no. Now, if you have a majority that says yes, how could anyone dream that the answer would be no? How could Rav Yosef, who comes much after the Tanoim, how could Rav Yosef say that greater is the study of Torah than the saving of life? Which now will have to apply to a case like this. How could he side with the minority? So the answer that we came up with is, why does the Megillah bother to tell you? Why does the Megillah bother to tell you? The Megillah says he's acceptable to the majority of his brothers. Brothers means people on his level, like the Sanhedrin. And not to the minority. Why bother telling us that? Who needs to know it's a minority and not a minority? That the Megillah, that's written, the Ruach HaKodesh, written with the Holy Spirit, comes to tell us that the judgment from above is that the minority was right in this case. You could read it that way. You don't have to read it that way, but you could read it that way. And Rabbi Yosef says that that's the way I'm reading it. I'm reading it that the minority was right because the Megillah indicates that this is a special case. And therefore, I hold that under those conditions, Mordechai was wrong in what he did. The Taz is not really talking about that case. The case we're talking about with Mordechai is halacha lemaisa, what should you do? The minority said he shouldn't have done what he did. Why? Because it's an amorphous case. It's not a clear case. It's a case where the danger isn't clear enough to make it a clear halacha. The Taz says, from here you see how great Talmud Torah is. And he applies it to a case which is slightly different. A case where definitely it's a clear and present danger, and you have to go save the person. You definitely do. But you should know you're losing out. It's not a directly parallel case. It's not directly parallel what the Taz is saying. The Taz is just making a general remark about the greatness and importance of Talmud Torah. According to this reading that I'm suggesting now, then it's not obvious that you have to hold against this position in the Gemara that Mordechai was wrong, and Rabbi Yossi says, great is Talmud Torah, and the Taz. You could go with it consistently, although the Maharal is on my side, Baruch Hashem. You know, that's a big person to have on your side. Maharal does say we should go with the majority against the minority. Mordechai did was right, and he cancels it out. But there's another way to read the Gemara where it's possible to hold the other side. So that, I think, now is much closer to the truth. And as I say, it shows that I wasn't totally wrong. But there is possibility of saying it that way. It'd be nice if those who would say it that way, and you'll hear this. If you stay in yeshiva long enough, you'll hear this more than once. The greatness of Talmud Torah to encourage you to learn more, and so forth and so on. It would be nice if they would find some commentator who would say it that way. Some commentator would take issue with the Maharal and say, no, we hold with the minority. This is why we hold with the minority. If you hear somebody repeats this idea to you sometime, challenge him and ask, and tell him the Maharal says no. Who's on the side that says yes? And see what you get. We couldn't find it. We looked around, but of course we didn't look at every possible safety. and we couldn't find it. Now, your question.
What exactly is the power of the head of the Sanhedrin? How is it different from the other 70 people?
I don't understand your question.
He's the head of Sanhedrin.
What's the power of being head of Sanhedrin?
Yeah.
Nothing, really. You vote one, your vote counts as one, like everybody else. I don't know whether he has some authority to convene this at everybody, but in terms of discussing issues and voting, it goes in front of anybody else. Okay? All right. Now, there are a couple of philosophical themes, aside from what we're going to talk about tonight, which is a giant, a large-scale question. A couple of interesting philosophical themes in the Megillah, which it's important to know and register. Rav Dessler gives the following picture. This is a kind of underlying theme, a subtext, if you take into account what Chazal say, that's communicated by the Megillah. Ahasuerus throws a party. And every group in the empire is invited to the party. 127 provinces, who knows how many different ethnic groups. And everything is done according to your local customs. And the Jews are invited also. Even though they're scattered and despised and downtrodden groups, everybody is invited. So the question arises, what should we do? Participate or not? Mordechai, as head of Sanhedrin, says, no, we shouldn't go. A delegation of Jews comes to Mordechai and says, listen, Mordechai, you understand, there will be 127 different groups represented there. If we're going to be the only ones not there, people are going to wonder, as Gary Hart wondered about the ability of certain Americans to distinguish between their American loyalty and the loyalty of the countries from which they once came. He said this in public 2 weeks ago, last week. There's a little anti-Semitism coming out. Are you Americans or Israelis? What are you really? And the senator from Virginia, who said, or the representative from Virginia, who said that it's Jews who are pushing America into a war. So they said to Mordechai, you know, if we're the only ones who don't go, we're pushing certain political buttons and we could suffer from it. Mordechai said, and then they said to him, Mordechai, listen, if there's a halacha that we can't go, if it says in Shulchan Aruch that we can't go, yeah, I know, Shulchan Aruch wasn't written there, but I'm just saying it, you know? Okay. Then we won't go. We're as firm as you are. Just tell us, what halacha is it that would be breaking by going to the party? Mordechai says, there's no halacha you're breaking. Everything is badatz, right? You don't have to do halacha on Shabbos. I'm telling you, it's not right to go. So the delegation said, Mordechai, you go back to your books, into your ivory tower, go back to your research, leave practical politics to us. And they went. There was a delegation of Jews there, just like everybody else. What was the result? What happened after the party? It was 9 years of status quo. Nothing happened for 9 years. Ask Rav Dessler, if we had been there, what would we have said? We would have said that Mordechai is out of touch. He's out of touch. He doesn't know what's going on. Listen, you have to deal with social problems, you have to deal with political problems. You need people on the ground. You need people in the streets. You need people who know the pulse of the people and the pulse of the empire. And leave it to them. Mordechai's going to research the lungs of chickens. Let him research that, you know. But leave practical problems to those people who know best what's going on in the street. Okay. 9 years later, Haman becomes prime minister. And the king makes a law. Everybody has to bow down to Haman. And everybody bows down to Haman. Except, guess who? Mordechai. The same delegation comes to Mordechai and says, Mordechai, listen, you're not bowing down to him. This guy is unstable, you know, and he's a little nutty. And who knows what could happen? Now tell us, Mordechai, Is there a law which says that we're not allowed to bow down to him, a halacha? If there is, we won't bow down either. We're just as firm as you are. Tell us, what's the halacha? Now here, as some of you may know, there are different opinions of Chazal. Some say that he wore an idol around his neck. He had a statue hanging from a chain around his neck. Some say he made himself into a god. But there are others who say it was just a political move. Just a political move. Respect to the prime minister. So, according to that statement of Chazal, just respect to the prime minister, Mordechai says to them, there is no explicit rule. There is no explicit halacha. It's my das. That's a key word, supposed to press a button. It's my das, it's my judgment that you shouldn't bow down. What's the result? The result is a decree of annihilation against the whole Jewish people. As Rav Dessler, if we had been there, what would we have said? We would have said, this fellow Mordechai is very dangerous. Not only is he out of touch, but he's dangerous. He's living in his fantasy land, and he's playing these games with these abstract laws of ancient Jewish lore and custom. And in the meantime, he's behaving in such a way as to put the whole Jewish nation in danger. That's what we have said. We would have said. Now, says Rav Dessler, with hindsight, looking back, we know, of course, that Mordechai was right. But it sure didn't look that way. It sure looked as if he was dead wrong. Says Rav Dessler, this is a very important lesson to us. The temptation to say that the Gedolim are out of touch, they don't know what's happening, they're not aware of what's really going on, and to feel that their judgment doesn't apply to everyday matters where we have to deal with political and social realities, that's a terrible temptation. And it's a terrible mistake. And for those for whom Das Torah is an issue, this is a good illustration of it. But it wasn't invented 120 years ago to shore up Agudas Israel as some totally irresponsible people will tell you. But rather, they are the only ones with clarity of das to be able to see the true reality and know how to react, respond to it. That's as far as Rav Dessler goes in his analysis. Now I want to take it a step further. I hope and I believe and I pray that what I'm telling you now Rav Dessler would agree to. What turned it around? Mordechai tells Esther she's got to go in to plead with the king. Esther says to Mordechai, okay, you want me to go in and plead with the king right away? You and all the Jews in Shushan will fast for 3 days and three nights, and then I'll go in. Now, one of those nights is the night of Pesach, which means that for that year, they're not going to eat matzah. And I told you, when we went through the Megillah, it says, Vayavar Mordechai. Mordechai crossed over. Some of the Mefarshim explained he crossed over his own judgment. He felt, how can you please God? How can you win God's favor? How can you get God's mercy by violating his law? You know, the logic just doesn't work that way. Doesn't make sense. In the Midrash, Esther tells Mordechai, and if we're all wiped out by Haman, who will eat matzah next year? So you have to fast absolutely and skip matzah in Jerusalem. That's what she said. He says, Vayaber Mordechai Vayas. Gosh, it tips all of Esther. He did what Esther commanded him to do. It means he gave up his judgment to Esther. Now I want to ask, if we had been there, what would we have said? I think we would have been totally convinced by Mordechai's argument. You don't win God's favor by violating God's law. It's illogical. So they had that argument. They had that argument that it's illogical. But they did it anyway. They did it anyway. They said, if Mordechai and Esther agree that this is what has to be done, then this is what has to be done, even though to us it's illogical. And that was the turning point. The turning point was when they accepted Das Torah. When they said, yes, it is illogical to us, so what? Who says our logic is so great? Who says our judgment is so great? And they're able to be machnir themselves, to subjugate themselves to the judgment of Mordechai and Esther. That was the turning point. And that's how the issue of the salvation took place. Are you with me? Okay, as you can imagine, this is a very important idea. Now, another thing, this is an idea that just occurred to me 2 days ago, yesterday actually on Shabbos, and sometimes it takes you 30 or 40 years to wake up. Really, if you look at it, the Jews in Shushan and in the Babylonian Empire failed in various ways. Going to the party. By the way, what was wrong with going to the party? Mordechai said his judgment was he shouldn't go. Why? What could have been the problem with going to the party? If the food is kosher and the wine was kosher and the Nochil Shabbos, so what was the difficulty over there? So I told you, when we started off the Megillah, what was Ahasuerus celebrating? What was he celebrating? The 70 years that have passed. The Nevi'im said that the Golus in Babylon will be 70 years, and then you'll be redeemed. God will take you back. He had a count, and according to his count, the 70 years went by, and the Jews didn't go back. So he feels secure now. Nothing's going to happen to him in his kingdom. Feels great. That's terrific. So what is he celebrating? He's celebrating either the fact that the Jewish prophecy is false, or the fact that they continue to be punished anyway, they don't deserve to be redeemed. He's celebrating the collapse of Yiddishkeit. That's what he's celebrating. And you're going to his party? You're joining in the celebration of the collapse of Yiddishkeit? How is that possible? Now, is there a halacha here? No, you can't find a halacha here. But in Mussar, it's quite obvious that this is the wrong thing to do. Quite obvious. Okay, then you could say, what do people think? And dual loyalties, Gary Hart. But there's obviously a problem here. So Mordechai said that it shouldn't be done. Yeah.
In Rashi, there in the pasuk, it says that they bowed down to at the time of Nebuchadnezzar, yes. They bowed to Avodah Zorah, and that they were men of Masudas Achashverosh.
Does it say they bowed to Avodah Zorah, or did it say they bowed to the statue of Nebuchadnezzar?
I think Avodah Zorah, no?
Okay, you have to check, because I just happened to learn a Tosfos 3 hours ago, and Tosfos proves that the statue of Nebuchadnezzar to which they were supposed to bow was not an Avodah Zorah. He has several proofs from the Gemara. This is in the beginning of Avodah Zorah.
But either way,
whatever they did wrong, yeah?
So I was thinking, because when I was learning this with someone, because it doesn't really seem to add up, the latter seems much worse. Like here, there's no specific thing that you did wrong. The thing that that's what I actually said, don't ask about it, like that. Because by Nebuchadnezzar, it was a situation in the world that they were forced to into this kind of situation. So okay, that happens, it's bad. But then, if you let them run away from that so much, then you show that that was a big thing for you. Or the next opportunity they get to be close to Russia, and they don't have to go, they straight away go back. So that's the problem. The problem is that you're doing it together. That's why he has to say it one after the other.
Very interesting. A very interesting analysis. I will just suggest for your further thought, a sort of category that's worth taking into account. How serious a transgression is not always measured by how serious the prohibition is. There are transgressions where the prohibition may be very trivial, and yet the significance of violating it is gigantic. It doesn't always, even though you would think intuitively it would have to. If it's more serious, then it should be a much more serious legal prohibition. No, it isn't always that way. But what you're saying is very nice. It's a nice analysis of the connection. Yeah.
Isn't that halacha that they, you know, use kelim from Beis HaMikdash, but that's where they worked?
So this is part of it. You're right, I forgot to put that in. Part of the celebration was that he used vessels from the temple, vessels that were in the treasury house of Nebuchadnezzar. So here you are really seeing the degradation of everything you believe in and stand for and value, and you're going and joining in.
Yes, I will. You know, use the vessels.
Well, okay, but
so besides, it's not like them morally; it's just halacha that now they use
even. Yes, but I assume that the vessels from the temple that were on the table were used only by the king. I don't think that he allowed the various participants to use those vessels. That would be very special. But for you to be there while it's happening, you know, would be unbelievable to participate in it. Okay, now let me ask you. If this is the problem. The problem is bowing down to an idol. And the problem is participating in the feast of Ahasuerus, which is terrible because he's celebrating the death, the destruction of Jewish prophecy and redemption. Has this got anything to do with Amalek? Is there any logical connection here to Amalek? If God needed an instrument to punish the Jews or to awaken them to the seriousness of their crime, to make them do tshuva, is there any reason why the person chosen should be an Amalekite and it should be his group of Amalekites that are the instrument over here? Well, is there any reason why that there's some connection here to centuries-old conflict between the Jewish people and Amalek, going back a thousand years to Yaakov and Esav? Why are these two themes intertwined here? Because Baruch Hu used lots of people to punish us. Nebuchadnezzar didn't come from Amalek. He's the one who destroyed the temple. It had nothing to do with Amalek. The Romans didn't come. They come from Esav. I don't think they're connected to Amalek. So... what's the relationship here? You think,
I was saying that by Amalek, he wants to make the Jews that they weren't untouchables and that you can't override the Jews. And here, Ahasuerus is showing that the years pass and see if we're going to override the Jews again over here now.
So Ahasuerus is a continuation of what Amalek tried to do in the beginning, in a way. Well, let me ask you a question. When we came into Eretz Israel, I don't know if anybody knows this, a little bit specialist information here. When we came into Eretz Israel, Chazal said there were three mitzvahs that we should do, in a certain order. What are the three mitzvahs? This took a long time, it didn't happen right away. The first mitzvah was to make a king. The second mitzvah was to fight Amalek. And the third mitzvah was to build the temple. In that order. So it comes out that as a prelude to building the temple, there has to be an effort to wipe out Amalek. Now, you're coming to the end of the period of exile in Babylon. At the end of that period, the temple is going to be rebuilt. Therefore, a conflict with Amalek, and at least an effort to wipe out the visible elements of Amalek, is a necessary prelude. And that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu chose Amalek as the instrument of punishing the Jews for their failure in Babylon, because in that way, the conflict with Amalek can be settled, at least to the extent where they were able to do so, and that could be the prelude to building the Beis HaMikdash. Comes out in terms of the themes of Jewish history, it comes out beautiful. So it's not backward looking. It's not because of what they did, but because of what they're going to do. Because of what they have to do and the prelude to it, that the instrument is Amalek, and when they go down, we fight a war and we're able to eradicate at least the visible, identified Amalekites, and that way have a prelude to the building of the Beis Hamikdash. You with me? Now, did I speak to you about Esther and Hester Ponim? Maybe I did speak to you about that. Esther, at the end of the Megillah, did I talk to you about that? I'm speaking to different groups. You know, at the end of the Megillah, we're all happy, the Jews are saved, and everything's wonderful, except that Esther remains married to this fellow and stays in the palace and bears him a son. The son doesn't behave like a Jew, even though, albeit Torah, he's Jewish. This is the most horrible fate for a Jewish girl that you could imagine. To be married to this goy, to bear him a son who's Jewish but doesn't function like a Jew. What kind of life is that? It's really pretty hard. Never wish this on your own daughter, granddaughter, you know. She grow up and be like Queen Esther. No thanks. Imagine the prophet saying, tell me what you want for your daughter and I'll ask the Kodesh Baruch Hu to give it to you. So I could be like Queen Esther, say no, thank you. Try somebody else. Anything else. Anybody else, not that. Not for my daughter. Yeah.
Why did Mordechai
Well, it isn't as if it was up to him, really. The guards went out and took the beautiful girls. You couldn't say to the guards, no, I don't want my daughter to go. It's not nice. We don't believe in that. What's that?
Doesn't have a
good advice. Oh, so the Gemara Sanhedrin, the 8th paragraph of Sanhedrin, discusses this in detail. The Gemara is a famous long place. It's over there. In the end, no, you don't have to die for it. Even if it's a Gilead Rice, you don't have to die for it.
Because she's a woman?
No. One teretz is because of Karka Olam, because she's totally passive. And the other teretz is that if it's Hanas Atzmo, he only did it for his own pleasure, not to make her violate the Torah, you don't have to do it. It's a whole...
Where's this
It's in the 8th paragraph of Sanhedrin. Famous Marley. So, I asked many people, what are we supposed to learn from this horrible fate of Esther? And my son-in-law, one of our sons-in-law, Slonim Chosid, gave me what I thought was the best explanation. The one says, Esther min haTorah minayin. Where do I have a hint to Esther from the Torah? And the answer is, the verse that says, God says, I will hide my face from them. The hastir in Hebrew is to hide, her name is Esther. In other words, her job is to live with God hidden. That's her job. Hiddenness is her challenge. Now, Golus in general means God is hidden. If we're in exile, and we're the ones who represent the Kodesh Baruch Hu in the world, and you know, when we are in exile, the word for that condition is Chilul Hashem. Chilul Hashem means a desecration of God's name. Why? Because people look at us and they say, oh, this is God's people. At least that's what they say. And look at them. Scattered, powerless, defenseless. Where is their God? Is he helping them? Is their God really powerful at all? Is he real at all? Maybe like the Christians say, he gave himself for somebody else. This is a gigantic desecration of God's name. It's a desecration of his name because what he really is can't be seen. So people are free to exercise their imaginations and create false ideas about him. That's what it means to desecrate his name. False ideas, degrading ideas. So, when we're in a case of exile, we are living with that hiddenness. Now, in that hiddenness, there's something to be conquered. The more God hides, the greater an achievement it is. to live in terms of him. It's just like reinforcement. You know, you want a child to learn something, you try to reinforce it. When the child matures, he's supposed to be able to do it without reinforcement. When a child's really mature, he's supposed to be able to feel that should feel that you can trust him on his own, when he's not going to get rewarded for doing the right thing, and he's not going to get punished for doing the wrong thing. Because a lot of what we do in life is like that. At least right away, there's no reward for doing the right thing, there's no punishment for doing the wrong thing. She had to live with almost virtually no encouragement at all. No Jewish encouragement at all. Indeed, the only reinforcement that she got, the only success she had, is success she didn't want. It's a gigantic success in all the wrong things. A gigantic success in all the wrong items. You know, it's a little bit like cancer. Isn't it good to grow? Isn't it good to be big? Tall? You know? Everybody wants to be tall. Everyone, you know, he's a big scholar. He's a big musician. He's a big brain. What? Big is, makes things good, except when tumors grow. And they grow big. And they grow and grow and grow. And then they kill people. That's not the sun. So, you know, is bigness always a success? It depends on what's growing. It depends on where it's growing. She had tremendous success in all the wrong things. In all the things that a Jewish person, in particular a Jewish woman, would not want to be successful in. It's one thing to be poor, or God forbid, to be ill, or to be running because of political instabilities or war. It's another thing to be queen, right, of a Goyish nation, living with a Goy, and bearing him a son who doesn't function like a Jew. You know, that's the worst possible success you can imagine. This is gigantic hiddenness, and that was her job. Her job was to live as a faithful Jew in the most excruciating divine hiddenness that you could imagine. You know, if you're suffering, if you're being tortured, so then you could say, I've done things wrong, and this should purify me. This should be a kapara for my generation or for the world. But here, you have everything. Money, luxury, a husband who adores you and who will do anything for you, up to half the kingdom. You know, that's not a bad deal, right? Except that he's an Oriental schlup, you know, he's a god. And you don't want this. I know, it's to me, it's heartbreaking to think about Esther. So what does this teach us? This teaches us that Kadosh Baruch Hu has jobs to be done, and some of them are really quite, quite excruciating. Some of the jobs that need to be done are quite excruciating, and if you get a difficult job, it's not because you're a failure. Esther was not a failure. Esther was not a low person. Esther was not a vicious person, a wicked person. And she was given an excruciatingly difficult job to do. A person should not feel that he's being punished by getting such a job, by being given such a job. It doesn't have to be a punishment. It could simply be, that's what needs to be done, and you're the right person to do it.
Let's see what else I can tell you in 5 minutes. I don't know if I mentioned to you, there's a Gemara which people repeat, and I heard a few days ago a Jewish Rashba on it, which made it much easier for me to relate to it. People say the Gemara like this. There will come a time when all the holidays will be buckled, they'll be no longer practiced, except for Purim. Purim will be practiced forever, because Megillah says that these days will never pass away from the Jews. Never pass away from the descendants. if it's a promise about these days specifically, then it means that others will pass away, and these won't, and these will be here forever. So we're supposed to imagine a time where there's no Pesach and no Shavuos and no Sukkot, probably no Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, nothing, no, not even a Hanukkah. Psh. Imagine living without a Hanukkah, impossible. Ah, but Purim, yes. Purim, yes. Always there'll be Purim. This is very peculiar. Because if you're talking about a time in the future when the mitzvahs no longer apply, which there will be, then all the mitzvahs won't apply. Talking about a time when the mitzvahs do apply, then all of them apply. The Mashiach. What is the Mashiach supposed to do? One of the things he's supposed to do is rebuild the temple. Why? So that we can reinstitute the sacrifices. No, all of the sacrifices include holiday sacrifices, coming up to the temple, offering your sacrifices when you come into the temple. What do you mean that the temple, the holidays won't be practiced? The Jewish Rashba says that's not what the Gemara means. What the Gemara means is this, that even if there will come a time when the powers over you will persecute you and will stop you from keeping all the other holidays, this holiday you'll be able to keep. This holiday is guaranteed to continue when all the mitzvahs apply and when, God forbid, there'll be such pressure from our enemies that we can't keep the other holidays. This holiday will always be able to keep. That's all. That's all it means to say. That shot, I can understand, I can relate that to the history as we understand it. I was so happy when he told me, one of the boys in the Royal Golem told me this shot to the Rashba, that now at least you could deal with it. Yeah.
How did the other Jews avoid having their daughters rounded up in this contest?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't know that they did. So you're asking, why isn't it just as bad for the other Jewish women who were involved in this sort of thing? They ended up in the harem. They didn't end up as queen. It's not a good idea to end up in the harem. I agree. I have no idea. It's a very good question. What happened to other Jewish daughters? I have no idea. That's a very good question. No idea. Very good. Gedal, you had a... something to say?
With the Mordechai event, you feel these things based on what he like, felt, and not based on any halacha. How could he do that?
So I thought I told you, I'll just rehearse this now in 2 minutes and I'll... When the Gemara talks about Svara, right? We talked about that? Svara is so powerful. Okay, then you're like, well, it's halacha. Yeah, but then the word... You could,
as far as to give halacha,
no? No, 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 no. When the Gemara says, they're looking for the source for a halacha, right? And it tries a verse, a verse from the Torah. Often the Gemara will challenge it and say, why are you looking for a verse from the Torah? It's svara. Svara hi lama likra. What do I need a verse for? It's svara. Now when the Gemara says svara, what does it mean? So here, our friends, the academics, the word friends here is in scare quotes, right? Our friends, the academics, will tell you svara means logic. Logic, if it's logical, that's equivalent to a verse from the Torah. Logic is a revelation like Sinai. That's what they'll tell you. And I told you this is based on Protestant theology, that the Protestant Christians say that everybody has God talking to him all the time, in his conscience, and that's how he knows what to do. They're putting Protestant theology into the Gemara. That's what they're doing, our friends, the academics. What Svara really means is, given everything I know about Torah, basing myself on the whole of the Torah, this is the right thing to do. That's what it means. As against basing myself on a specific verse, or a specific Mishnah, or a specific Brisa, or some specific statement, and deducing something from that specific statement, I'm taking a sense of the Torah as a whole, and I'm applying it to this particular case. And then what we're saying is this. Since the Torah as a unity already gives me a way to handle this case, I don't need another verse, an extra verse, to tell me what to do. It's redundant, because on the basis of the rest. It becomes, but the source of it.
Yeah, he saw this al svara, so then they come to him and say, "What are you doing?" You say, "Al svara, this is not lawful. You shouldn't bat down."
But of course, that is what he's saying, and they're saying to him,
"Svara." Pronouncing svara as a way of getting to Allah. That's a much bigger thing already. That's already denying one of the ways of learning.
Well, except that it's based on something very amorphous, right? It's based on his saying, "That's my sense of the Torah." So it's really him. They have to trust him. That's what Das Torah is. Das Torah is where a person or a group of people tell you, this is how we see the situation in terms of the Torah. They can't give you a proof. They can't cite a source for you. They can't show you any logic. They just say, this is the way we see it.
He's the only one who had a Das Torah high enough at that time to see this.
But now, that requires you to trust the person. You know very well that there are whole groups today who have rejected this whole concept on the grounds that they don't like it too much, you know, because it puts them under the judgment of these kinds of great people, great scholars. They just reject the whole concept. And so it's not so difficult to understand what that could have meant even at that time.
Thank you. Yeah, well, and obviously, I didn't find it. Hey, yes. Thank you.